Hello, and welcome to part two of our interview with Jonathan Cook, a KBOO News and Public Affairs special program airing this morning as part of the regular monthly program One Land, Many Voices. I'm William Seaman, and let me begin by apologizing for not being live in the studio with Hala. I regret not being there for what I expect will be an interesting and lively discussion this morning. But I look forward to being back in the studio with Hala next month, March 23rd, for the next broadcast of One Land, Many Voices. Jonathan Cook is a British journalist and author based in Nazareth, Israel. He has been reporting from the Middle East for 5 years, first writing for The Guardian newspaper, and in recent years publishing on websites such as Counterpunch, Antiwar.com, and ZNet. His book, Blood and Religion, The Unmasking of the Jewish and Democratic State, is just out from Pluto Press. I spoke with Jonathan Cook at his home in Nazareth on December 28, 2006. We rejoin the interview as Jonathan Cook is describing a number of ways Palestinian Israelis, non-Jewish citizens of the State of Israel, experience discrimination within Israeli society today.
Let's look at another issue, employment, for instance. Now, Israel was founded on important concepts inside labor Zionism, for instance, was the idea of what they called Hebrew labor, which was most colonial movements, when they come to another country, what they usually do is they try and use the labor of the natives. It's cheap, and they exploit the local people. Now, what was interesting about Israel when it first arrived, when Jews started arriving in the first waves of immigration to Palestine, was that they were actually discouraged from using the natives with this whole idea of Hebrew labor, that Jews were redeeming the land and so on. And that has continued. It hasn't ended just because Israel became a state. There's still this very strong notion of Hebrew labor, and it reaches all sorts of aspects of the economy. There's the most obvious way it's used, which is that by the government, which says that all sorts of areas of the economy are security-related, and so Palestinian citizens aren't allowed to work in them. And that can include anything, really, you can think of, including, for instance, textile factories. Israel used to have a very large textile industry, which has ended. But a lot of the textile industry here was based around the making clothes and uniforms for the army. So Palestinians weren't allowed to be employed in these factories because this was considered to be security-related work. There's a huge armaments industry here, which, of course, Palestinians are not allowed to be involved in. There's the airports, which the Palestinian citizens can't be involved in. There's the whole security industry itself. It's very difficult for Palestinians to get employment in the police force here. Even inside their own communities, there are very limited numbers of Palestinians are allowed to become members of any of the security forces. The Shin Bet, for instance, they're almost entirely excluded from. So there are large areas of the economy which the government says people can't be employed in. There are also many jobs where you need to have worked in the army before you find employment. That excludes most Palestinians as well. There's the, if you like, the popular racism of Israeli Jewish employers who would rather employ a Jew than a Palestinian. So there's that level of discrimination. So at various levels, it becomes, if you're a Palestinian here, it's very difficult to find work. Most of the Palestinian community here before 1948 were engaged in labor, in agricultural labor. They were working as farmers on their land. Now, most of that land, as we'll get to next, was confiscated. So they don't have their farmland anymore. So what kind of employment is left open to them? Very little. Most of it's service industries and also working inside the Jewish economy, but as very low-paid casual laborers the kibbutz farms. They sometimes work as day laborers there. There's quarries, for instance. They sometimes work in the quarries. There are some factories where they work as well, meat processing factories and so on. But they're very also, of course, the building sites. They build most of the country as well, Palestinian citizens, and also Palestinians from the occupied territories. You've got to remember that they very similar employment patterns there. You know, who was building the wall? Who is building the wall? Unfortunately, it's mostly Palestinians because there's not many other ways that they can work. So Israel has really had a stranglehold on what kind of employment is available to Palestinians on both sides of the Green Line. And it's restricted that very much to casual low-paid labor, and there's very high labor unemployment rates in Palestinian communities. Typically, the official figures are double what they are in the Jewish community. Actually, it's much, much higher than that because the figures themselves conceal the discrimination. There are many reasons why Palestinians inside Israel cannot claim unemployment benefit and are not included in the unemployment figures. Some of the organizations in Nazareth who work with the unemployed suggest that the figures may be four times higher in the Palestinian community than in the Jewish community. So whereas there's about 9-10% unemployment in the Jewish community, it could be up to 40% unemployment in the Palestinian community. So it's very, very high. That's employment. Let's now look at land. Land, which is a very important issue here because it's been the bedrock of the Palestinian identity. I mean, it was a farming, rural, peasant community until 1948, largely. And land was key to the community's sense of their own identity and who they were. Now, what Israel has done is nationalized most of the land inside Israel, as I said. 93% of it is nationalized and off-limits, effectively, to Palestinians. It means that they can't have any control of their own planning or their own communities. Most of the communities here, I mean, you see it in Nazareth, they're extremely tightly built Palestinian communities. There's really massive overcrowding in them. There's also massive illegal building, which Israel likes to talk a lot about. Well, there's a good reason why there's a lot of illegal building, which is it's almost impossible to get a building permit if you're a Palestinian. And that's, again, true in the occupied territories and inside Israel. The parallels are always there. So if you're a Palestinian inside Israel, not only do you have no control over your own communities, the municipality often has no control over its own communities because the planning decisions are taken by planning committees, which again exclude Palestinian citizens. They're not entitled to make their own planning decisions. So Jews decide whether you can build buildings inside Palestinian communities, including inside Nazareth. So if you want to get a building permit, you have to go to a Jewish planning committee, which makes a decision for you. Usually it turns you down, which is why there's so much illegal building inside Palestinian communities, because they can't get permission to build. And that means that not only do the elected representatives of the community not have control over their communities, it means that most people here end up finding themselves being increasingly criminalized, which is another concept which is probably difficult for people to understand. But the idea that you have no choice. Imagine living with your parents, getting married, and expecting, as most of us would do, to be able to go and live in our own home. Here it's a big problem. You can't. There are no Palestinian communities have been built inside Israel since 1948. It's the same number of communities, 123, that existed in 1948. So where you can live is only in the communities that existed in 1948, pretty much on the same land that was developed since then. So, for instance, you can't, as a young professional couple here, go and buy yourself an apartment in another community. Perhaps a new community had been built where you might be able to create the kind of networks of organization, a sense of your own community, establish new ideas about how to live in a new community. These kind of possibilities are totally denied to you. You have to live in the communities where your parents live. Now, what happens for most people is that they end up building on top of their parents' home. Those homes are usually illegal, and in building an illegal home on top of your parents' home, you make your parents' home illegal as well. This works at all sorts of levels in terms of creating stresses within the community. There's no real professional class, and there never has been a professional class inside Israel among the Palestinians, because people cannot develop their careers in terms of employment. They can't get kinds of jobs that would lead to a professional class here. For instance, engineering is not allowed. I know several people who are trained as engineers, but they can't get jobs as engineers because nobody will employ them to be an engineer, because most of the engineering projects here are seen as security related. Again, they're often to do with the occupation, building settlements in the occupied territories, or the infrastructure that leads to these settlements. So you can't get a job, for instance, as an engineer. So not only is there not really a professional class here because of employment restrictions, but also because of the very tight nature of people's geographic location. You end up living next to your parents, and that might not sound so bad, but in terms of the way that the society itself can develop, it's extremely restrictive. It means that people don't have the freedom to break with the traditions of their community, what they end up doing is having, because of social pressures, to lead lives very similar to their parents' lives. It becomes a kind of restriction, a break on where you can head, how different you can be. These are like very, if you like, rural communities. Even though Nazareth is a fairly large city, it's 70,000 people, and it lives there. There is a number of communities bordering, our Palestinian communities bordering Nazareth, which make up a kind of conurbation of about 190,000 people. The communities dotted around Nazareth, people still living the way they were living 30, 40, 50 years ago, because there's no place where young Palestinians, young professionals can reinvent their identity, reinvent their kind of lives that they want to lead, and break away from the restrictions of the society that are already here. And Israel wants that. I mean, that's planned. I mean, that's the intention, is to ensure that the focus of people's lives is extremely restricted, extremely narrow, and that they can't start to reimagine a way of living or organize in ways, new ways.
It's hard not to interpret some of these policies, certainly those Israeli policies imposed in the occupied territories and also those imposed on Palestinian Israelis, to interpret these policies as a deliberate effort to drive Palestinians out, to force them to see their future as professionals, as academics, as lawyers or doctors, to see their future outside of Israel, to leave the country, to go somewhere else, to go to Europe or go to the United States.
Well, I'll give you a good example. There's been a campaign here among the Palestinian citizens of Israel for many decades to create Israel's first Arab university, teaching in the Arabic language. It's never been allowed. Israel has always made sure that it wouldn't happen. Now, there are good reasons why it doesn't want an Arab university. It would help create this professional class, this leadership that would help organize Palestinians inside Israel, give them new vision, new understanding. What happens instead is that if you don't want to go to an Israeli university where you're going to have to be taught in Hebrew, which is your second language, and it immediately puts you at a disadvantage against Israeli Jewish pupils, who you're competing with, your options are to go to Jordan, for instance, and go to one of the universities there, which a lot of Palestinian students now do. They go to Jordan and they study at one of the universities in Amman. Now, once they finish that education, there's a good chance they meet somebody there, maybe a Jordanian, and maybe they think to get married. And there's a good chance that they won't come back. And that's exactly how Israel likes it. And you'll see that in all sorts of policies that are here, which encourage people to leave. One of the few political parties, dissenting non-Zionist political parties that were allowed inside Israel, was the Communist Party. It was mainly because in its early days, the Jewish community was the organizers and leaders of the Communist Party inside Israel. So it was difficult to ban it. But one of the benefits for Israel in terms of its Palestinian community was that the Communist Party used to give grants to Palestinians to go and study. Most Palestinian intellectuals here could not get to an Israeli university. The restrictions were too severe. So if you wanted to get an education as a doctor, as a dentist, as a lawyer, some of the main trades that are allowed here, as I said, the service industries, what would typically happen is that you would join the Communist Party here and then apply for a scholarship. And often people got scholarships. A number of people I know here who speak East European language. I mean, all sorts of languages, Moldovan, Hungarian, Russian. And that's because they studied and trained in the communist bloc, in the Soviet bloc. Now, many of them didn't come back. They married a Moldovan or Hungarian, and they stayed there. And again, Israel was quite happy with that arrangement and encouraged it. And it was one of the reasons it made it so difficult for one. I mean, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons it made it so difficult for Palestinian citizens to get to Israeli universities, as is still the case. It's still extremely difficult for them to get to universities and still underrepresented there.
What are some of the other elements of the conflict that you address in your book?
I think the other really important issue, which we haven't mentioned so far, is and it's a key question for Israel, again, both sides of the Green Line, is the question of demography, the question of numbers. Who has the larger number of people? And that's been a Zionist obsession, as we know, since before 1948. It was one of the driving forces for the whole program of ethnic cleansing that was carried out in 1948. Because Israel, to be a Jewish state, needs a very strong Jewish majority. Otherwise, it doesn't have the legitimacy. If it's kind of 50% Palestinians, 50% Jews, difficult to sell that idea of a Jewish state as a legitimate idea. So Israel has been working assiduously for many decades to ensure that demographically it's in control, that it has the higher numbers. Now, one of the questions that I look at in the book is this whole problem of the numbers game for Israel. One of the things that Ehud Olmert mentioned in November 2003 in an interview in Haaretz, shortly before Ariel Sharon announced the disengagement, in an interview he said, the biggest threat to us, I'm paraphrasing here, but the biggest threat to us would be if the Palestinians start a campaign, a struggle for one man, one vote, just as the blacks did in South Africa under apartheid, because this would look like a legitimate struggle. And that would be dangerous to us as a Jewish state. And it's not insignificant that a month later, Ariel Sharon mentioned for the first time at the Herzliya conference his idea for disengagement from Gaza, because the two ideas are intimately linked. The disengagement from Gaza, and this is one of the major arguments I make in the book, was entirely a demographic move. It was a way of buying time for the state, just as demographers inside Israel were warning that the numbers of Palestinians and Jews were reaching parity, that within ten years, there would be a similar number of Jews and Palestinians inside the greater Israel area. It was at that point that Sharon was sold on the idea of the disengagement. Gaza had never been particularly important to the Zionist dream. It had a large number of Palestinians, 1.4 million of them. By getting rid of them, severing them off from the greater Israel dream, he immediately bought Israel a couple of decades to sort out its other demographic problems, which was Palestinians inside Israel and also the Palestinians in the West Bank. So, and I think it's important to realize that the demographic threat is seen to be as much inside Israel, if not more inside Israel, than it is in the occupied territories. This is often overlooked. And Israel has been working very carefully over the last few years to manage the demographic problem inside Israel. And that's where we're seeing the new ideas, like the Lieberman ideas, about transferring the population from inside Israel into the occupied territories. And one of the major arguments I'm making in the book is that the disengagement and the idea of convergence, which has now been put on hold, but effectively it's happening anyway because the West Bank wall is still being built. I mean, that's the new line, political line Israel is creating. Well, what's the significance of that political line? And I think the significance of it is that Israel will create some kind of series of ghettos which it will then want the international community to call a Palestinian state. And it will then say, well, that is the place where the Palestinians have their right to the recognition and to exercise their sovereign rights. That is a Palestinian state. If you want to be a Palestinian, go to that Palestinian state. And that's basically Lieberman's argument. His argument is, if you want to be a Palestinian and you're a citizen of Israel, well, then you have to renounce your citizenship and go and live in that Palestinian state. That's the whole concept of this transfer of the Little Triangle, this area that's very close to the West Bank, which he wants to be moved in on the other side of the wall, so it will become effectively part of this Palestinian state, this pseudo-Palestinian state that they're talking about. They're also talking about the idea that if you want to demand a state of all its citizens, which is seen as treasonous and subversive, that will become an illegitimate political platform inside Israel. It already, in fact, is an illegitimate platform. It's not possible as a political party to stand here and demand or to not acknowledge Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. It hasn't been enforced yet, but that is the law. So at some point, we can assume that Israel will start enforcing that. But what people are talking about is loyalty oaths. And I think that's what's likely to for the rest of the Palestinian community inside Israel to face quite soon will be these loyalty oaths. You will have to pledge allegiance to Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, which will negate any claims you might have to Israel being a state of all its citizens. That's the way you negate that threat. You say, well, if you want to live inside Israel and be a Palestinian, you have to acknowledge that Israel is a Jewish and democratic state, and you can't challenge that. And if you want to, then you have to go and live in this pseudo-Palestinian state we're creating next door. I think that's the game plan. How soon it will be realized, how effectively, is difficult to say. But that's the vision that emerged. I think that's the Sharon vision. It's the Olmert vision. And I think it's also the army's vision. And that's what we're seeing being created at the moment, a series of ghettos which will be called a Palestinian state. They'll be behind a series of walls and fences. And if you want to be a Palestinian inside Israel, then you're going to have to say, okay, well, my Palestinian identity is just, it's just a kind of symbolic identity. It doesn't have any real meaning. And I pledge allegiance to Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, which, in other words, I have to pledge allegiance to a state which discriminates against me, which doesn't recognize me as an equal to a Jewish citizen. And that's going to put Palestinians inside Israel in a very difficult situation. They're going to be faced with a choice of either accepting their second or third class status inside Israel permanently, or leaving the state, going and living in a state which is, as we've seen in Gaza, even after the withdrawal of the settlers and of the army, it's no kind of life, it's no kind of statehood. It's a prison, a very large prison. And I don't think many Palestinian citizens of Israel are going to opt for that choice. So they're effectively going to have to buy into their second or third class citizenship. And I think that's a clever move by Israel, and it might well be bought by the international community.
I'd like to ask about countertrends. The description of these Bantustans, the strategy being imposed on the West Bank, it's not something new. We have the recent history of South Africa as a precedent, as a guide to where this may lead. What do you see as the countertrends, the reservoirs of hope, that another direction might be possible for the people of the region?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not great on hope. I will do my best, though. I think one has to recognize that all regimes learn from their predecessors' mistakes. And I have no doubt there were very close ties between Israel and apartheid South Africa. And I have no doubt that Israel has learned the lessons from apartheid South Africa's failure. And it will not repeat them exactly. It will change the format and the implementation enough. It hopes that it can, that the international community will buy it. And that's really what matters, or Americans will buy it, the American regime will buy it, which is what really counts. So I think there's that first obstacle, I mean, that anybody who opposes what's going on faces, is that Israel isn't going to be stupid and just replicate apartheid South Africa. It's going to do it more cleverly. And so we're going to have to be more clever in our arguments. The second thing is that we have an obstacle which the opponents of apartheid South Africa didn't have, which is that if we criticize Israel, we're called anti-Semites. That's a very powerful argument. It's a very powerful argument for most people. And it's a big problem. You know, if you opposed apartheid South Africa, what did people call you? You know, they didn't have a word for it. I mean, if you supported the rights of the black people of South Africa, in general, that was seen as a good thing. It helped also that America has a large black community population, and so you had support on your side if you were fighting for the rights of the black population of South Africa. Now the problem in America is almost reversed, where you have a large, or not maybe such a large community, but you have a significant, influential Jewish community who, in the main, are quite supportive of Israel. Not on everything, but still fairly supportive, and so. The power balance is rather different, I think, in this case, and it's much harder to argue your case. There aren't so many Palestinians inside America, and those that there are tend to keep their heads down rather than out there arguing vociferously for the rights of the Palestinians in the occupied territories. So I think we should be aware of those hurdles, those obstacles, and not suggest that it's going to be, the fight is as easy as it was in the case of apartheid South Africa. What hope is there? I think there's always the hope that that anyone arguing for and campaigning for universal rights and for justice, you know, you have right on your side. It's a powerful argument, and as long as it's heard, I think you can make a significant dent in a significant impression on people. I mean, I think there is also maybe a third element to this, a third obstacle, which I haven't mentioned also, which is the American media, which is not very supportive or very realistic about what's going on here, and is part of the problem as well, because it prevents ordinary Americans from really hearing what's going on. So that's another obstacle that, has to be confronted. But as long as we can make ourselves heard, we can make people realize what the issues are and what's going on, there is the hope that that message will be understood and will be powerful, because we're talking about universal rights here. We're talking about Palestinians having the same rights as, Israeli Jews. So that's one small ray of hope. I think the other hope is that Israeli Jews are starting to realize that Palestinians, I mean, there's been a process for the Israeli Jewish population here. They've undergone a series of stages of recognition of the Palestinians, which may be difficult to, for us to imagine that they would have been able to, for instance, recognize the idea of a Palestinian state 20 or 30 years ago. People didn't talk in those terms. I mean, I have Israeli Jewish friends, older ones, who remember a time when it was just not possible to talk about Palestinians ever having a state. Well, it is possible to talk about that now. I don't think it's very realistic. Most Israeli Jews' understanding of what might be needed to create a Palestinian state isn't very realistic yet, but at least they've made that kind of mental leap. And that's a first stage. I think the communities, the small groups I was talking about earlier, like Zohrot, and there are other ones, Tayush is another one, important one. These small groups are very active, they're very vociferous, and they're very committed, and they are slowly starting to make an impression. There was a lot of hostility, for instance, as I mentioned, to Zohrot when they first started their activities. But in general, I've noticed, and I know from Etin Bronstein, who's the director of Zohrot, that there's a larger number of Jews who are at least curious about what they're doing. Maybe not approving of it, but curious. Not immediately hostile. When he first started doing these signposting projects in the destroyed villages, he was just met with hostility, and sometimes with physical violence. Now, more often, there's a curiosity. There's a sense of, who are you? What are you doing? Why are you doing it? And that's a change, and it's an important change, and it's the beginning of a process of understanding. It leads somewhere hopeful. And that's, to me, the small sign of hope that I cling to, that if Israeli Jews can start to want to know why somebody might want to put a signpost up with an Arabic name on it, that's a beginning. And it's a small one, but it's a beginning, and it could lead to something significant. So that's maybe the hope I can offer, but I appreciate it's not a huge one.
You've been listening to part two of an interview with Jonathan Cook. Jonathan Cook is a British journalist and author based in Nazareth, Israel. His book, Blood and Religion, The Unmasking of the Jewish and Democratic State, is just out from Pluto Press. I spoke with Jonathan Cook at his home in Nazareth on December 28, 2006. You can hear this entire program, parts one and two, as streaming audio at our website, www.pdxjustice.org. where you'll also find interviews with Ali Abu Nima, Phyllis Bennis, Ilan Pape, and many others. And now we turn to the second half of One Land, Many Voices, with your host, Hala Gores.